So, first of all, for my documentation purposes, just tell me who you are in any way you'd like to describe yourself.
I'm Claire Pentecost. I'm an artist and writer and educator. I live in Chicago, but I'm from the Southeast. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Now I know why Paul loved you so much. Yes. That's awesome. No, I'm just kidding. Fantastic. So we were just talking, we were just rolling into what we were talking about before. So like, I guess one of the questions that everyone asks in these sorts of sessions and kind of in life these days, and around me anyway, is what we should be spending our time doing. And so one of the things is like the structure of these kinds of events, which we're at, tend to be activists, artists, people involved in institutional education, research cultures. So there's a spectrum of people who do spend their time, at least in kind of day-to-day basis, like in pretty vastly different ways. And so the question behind that question is like, what is your interest in coming to an event like the Anthropocene River, and what would you hope to get out of something like this? Or is it a complete experimental thing?
Wow. Well, your question, what is it we should be doing, is the question we ask ourselves all the time. I mean, it's because you can't take it for granted. I don't know if you ever could, but maybe there's an illusion that at one time it seemed pretty self-evident. But now, I mean, for instance, the whole, people always ask me questions about activism when I give an artist talk, and I don't consider my art activist, but I think it does have a position. It advocates a position, usually, and that somehow translates as activism. And I think, well, should I be spending more time being an activist? And I was, many years ago, a community organizer, and it was totally engrossing. I mean, we worked all the time. And I really don't know if, like, straight-up activism is more effective than doing cultural work. Because I think that, basically, our problems are cultural. I mean, I think we can solve things technologically. I think we have the technology. But we don't have a cultural set of values that wants to go there. And I think a lot about redefining a picture of the good life. Like, what does it mean to live a good life? And, you know, the American dream is so archaic. And it influences the whole world. And that's got to be rethought. And, you know, I have this, there's a quote by Darwin that I really love. It's in his last monograph, was on the earthworm. And in the introduction, he says, there's a phrase where he says, "For those of you who are not interested in small agencies and their accumulated effects, you won't be interested in this book." And that phrase, "small agencies and their accumulated effects," I feel like that's what I have to put my faith in, because what else can we do, you know, except apply ourselves that way. Okay. The other thing is, I think it's got to be collective, right? And so things like this help me connect with people who also are asking the same questions. And I get really irritated when in public forums where people say, like, "you're just preaching to the choir," etc. And I think, shit, our heads are being filled all day long, every day, from all sides with this other crap. And we've got to preach to each other. I mean, not preach, but we've got to connect and strengthen each other's resolve and ingenuity and interdependence, because we can't do it alone. And I also think that's just a way of dismissing the smaller, the kind of subcultures of thinking differently. It just really annoys me. And I think, what was the other thought I had just now? It's almost like we live by repetition. I mean, you know, if you read Judith Butler or whoever, you know, identity is made through repetition. And so you kind of have to give yourself these places. And I think the right has had think tanks, and, you know, they do this kind of thing all the time. And there's power in it. So I definitely try to avail myself of surrounding myself with people who do feel the urgency, right, that we're that's facing us now.
Beautiful. You do you know this Rebecca Solnit essay about the preaching to the choir?
No, I don't.
She's also, you know, has a force in her words, and it's an amazing little thing. I think it's like a Guardian article or something.
She's so prolific.
But she did this little thing that was about specifically the argument that actually the preacher is mostly preaching to the choir. You know, like, because they're the ones who have to have that force.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like that's
that,
right.
The dynamic between the preacher and the choir
right.
is exactly why people come.
Right.
So like if they have a well-rehearsed and rehearses maybe a repetitive
yeah.
kind of whatever identity or dynamic or, you know, energy, then that's what brings people to church. And so this is also a kind of, yeah, like it's in defense of preaching to the choir somehow. That
okay.
You need to bolster one another's resolve because mm-hmm. there's so much of that going on through corporate union.
Oh, there's so much counter. I mean, you just have to think about it. It's just like a million messages a day. I mean, literally. And you think about, okay, the average person who lives in a city probably sees 5,000 logos a day. And each one of those logos has been designed to grab your attention and hook you. And that's just one dimension of what we're up against, right? And the fantasy, the level of fantasy of, you know, once again, going back to this question of the good life, of like, what kind of fantasies are we feeding? And I'm not going to get, you know, dictatorial about people's fantasies. It's about what can we cultivate together that's not destroying the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so the second part of that question was, what is, because we're just at this specific place
yeah.
thing right now, like what drew you to this moment and this kind of engagement at Lake Itasca? You know, it's not an easy place to, you know, it's an easy place to get to, and you know, like what's the energy here that you were drawn to?
It's a whole combination. I mean, you know, I'm part of a group of people who's been very affected by the Anthropocene campus that Hakave put on, and because it was galvanizing,
yeah.
right? And so all these things that many of us were thinking about, I felt like it was trying to create an epistemic community that could even figure out how to approach our problems. And it has to be interdisciplinary, right? Because of the complexity of what we know and what we don't know. And so, well, you know, just the brief narrative is that out of 10 seminars in the last Anthropocene campus in Berlin, two of them were organized by groups from Chicago. So we went back and we said, we have this momentum. We let's see what we can do. So we created a collective called Deep Time Chicago. And it's, the sub little tag is cultural change in the Anthropocene. And we did debate whether even to use the word Anthropocene, because by then it was already being contested. And, you know, TJ Demos has a whole book against it. And I think it's a big distraction. And for myself, I thought, let's go with it, because people are already mobilizing around it. And because it really is descriptive. I mean, we can quibble about whether, you know, it really should it be the capital O scene and blah, blah, blah. But those are kind of academic questions to me. It's just the fact is to recognize the drama, really, of how we've reshaped the world and how it's reshaping us. That and I think it's limiting the human the human sensorium and the human idea of, well, you know, what does it mean to be human? I mean, these are really basic questions, but I think they're kind of what they're what drives me, and I feel like it's kind of like what we're doing here. Each one of us is like, how do we be human among other living things, right?
Yeah.
And so why this? Well, it's so exciting. I mean, we're going to be on canoes at the headwaters of the Mississippi. I mean, we've been thinking about the Mississippi for 2 years now, and it has such a mythic presence in the American psyche. And I mean, I read Tom Sawyer. I mean, no, Huckleberry Finn was my favorite book when I was a kid, and it's. So there's the whole kind of almost literary, mythic presence of it. And then it's, I like the idea of a case study because I think we learn through specifics. You know, we want to approach big questions, but if you just go straight for the big questions, you just wind up with cliches. With things you already know. So, and we've been doing projects for a long time about kind of on the ground learning, like what we used to call cartography with your feet. So, and this whole idea of kind of autonomous collective learning. And I mean, I'm really interested in learning. That's what I get up for. And I've been in an institution for 20 years, and I really feel the limits of what can happen in an institution. And in my own work, I've spent a considerable amount of energy advocating for kind of non-authorized positions in relation to knowledge. Like, who has the authority to interpret knowledge and to direct it, and it's not that I'm against experts at all. I mean, expertise is personally satisfying, and we've achieved amazing things with specialization, but that's not where we are now, and we need the value of a specialization is how it can connect with other forms of knowledge. You know, to approach the complexities of our world. Yeah, and it's physical. I mean, that's compelling.
And I'm trying not to laugh earlier when you're, because I ruined the recording, but you got so animated when you're like, going down the river.
Yeah,
like,
no.
That's the thing. That's what, why wouldn't you want to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah, totally. And we've been doing this. We've been very involved in this field station in Southern Illinois. And so I'm naturally, I mean, or just predictably curious about the other field stations. So this is putting us in contact with another. It just seems alive. It seems like a group of people who have not decided what the answers are. You know, Von Forrester, the biocomputing guy from like the 70s and 80s, talked about trivial machines and non-trivial machines. And you can think of an educational system as a machine. A trivial machine, you always know what you're going to get. You know, like a trivial question is one where you know the answer. And there's so much education is based on that. And non-trivial is a bona fide question, you know. It's like we don't know the answer, and I feel like that's where we have to go now. Because I came of age in this intellectual milieu where critique, gave us a lot of mastery, a sense of mastery. And I feel like that was, well, I felt the limits of it, and that, yeah, you get this mastery, but nothing changes, really. And I'm not saying abandon critique. It's like the first step, but it's only the first step. Then you have to start doing things that you are not masterful at, and so that you can discover something. So that's my proclivity.
It's a really fascinating way to juxtapose mastery and critique. It's a distancing position, isn't it? Something that
yes, it is.
You can see the whole, and you get like this kind of view of something. Like, that's what critique makes you feel like. You kind of maybe you get something everyone else doesn't.
Yeah.
The style of the
well,
the
it's also
critique that I know. Anyway.
My brother, who was an intellectual, told me, and I never verified this, but he told me that the whole concept comes from, in the Greeks, the people from outside who came to look at the games, the Olympic Games. It was the outsider's point of view that had a value, but, you know, it's not the whole picture. And I went to, okay, so a really important experience for me was I did the Whitney Independent Study Program in 89 and 90, and it changed my life. It was great, okay? It was really, it helped connect me with a lot of, it turned a lot of lights on for me, and connected me with some great people, etc. So last fall, I went to the 50th anniversary symposium. It was a big celebration of the program itself, okay? And I was so disappointed. I don't know what I expected, but the conversation was basically had the same parameters, okay? And in 3 days, no, 2 days, okay, there was only one talk that mentioned anything about our environmental crisis. There was Jonathan Crary, who talked about, he did a kind of a look at the media's treatment of climate change. And then later, I think I heard him right, in the discussion moment, he apologized and said, well, I'm sure my thing wasn't really appropriate for this. And I just felt like, it's kind of like what you were describing about Hakavei, you know, being in, you know, creating these discourses and then somehow letting them satisfy you, you know? And how are we going to get beyond that? So it's not to rag on the Whitney program. I mean, I still think it's a great program, but I just couldn't believe yeah, it was really the parameters, you know, the kind of Marxist, Freudian, and post-colonial. And, yeah.
There's a lot of influence of the New School for Social Research and this kind of crowd, right? Like it's a bit of tradition and...
Well, it's Marxist and the, you know, second generation, like Frankfurt School, Birmingham School, Lacan, you know,
it's the heavy hitters of that
it
era.
It is the heavy hitters of that era, but now it's, you know, it's 30 years since I went. It should have changed.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel the same way about, maybe that's why the self-critique is coming out of our little institutional structures too, because it's not fascinating anymore to be like a to me. I'm just chatting with you now.
Okay, right, right.
Sorry, because it's what you're hitting on is something that made me changed my life in some way, is that like, for a while it was fascinating to me to be critical of an institution that I didn't agree with and be inside it and all this kind of stuff. But when you start to really feel like the bus is broken, it's hard to get people on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like you get older and you kind of get representational in those structures, or you get more involved, or you become a full-time employee or whatever, as a faculty. It's just a similar thing. Like, I used to have this, oh, yeah, but I'm doing all this good work of critiquing that system. I don't know. It's a similar thought. Like, I think it kept a distance for me.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't maintain it anymore because it's, mm-hmm. it's not that fascinating anymore. It's just everyone knows it's broken.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Or like the whole gesture of unveiling, of like revealing that it's really like this, it's really like this. You know, or like looking below the surface to see why are things the way they are and why does everybody accept it. It's, after a while, it feels like disempowerment. You know, like you're just consenting to be like a peripheral saint or something. You know, you're on the sides and you're so smart and you're above it, but it's not changing. So I'd rather get in and make mistakes.
Right. Yeah, and synthesize something somehow. Or like, you know, go the other way a bit. After you've looked at all these parts and pieces, uh-huh. and you've done your critique, then what are you going to do? Just leave a Humpty Dumpty?
Yeah, right.
In pieces? Like, you have
like make a painting of it, yeah, you know? Exactly. Or, well, of course, it wouldn't be a painting. It would be a 3D. It would be like, now, what is it now that everybody's doing? 3D animation or like sure. where they're constructing reality?
Oh, VR.
Yeah. And this is my nightmare, is that the world will just become more and more degraded and everyone will be looking at their screens and prefer that. And it's funny because this is something I have researched for years. It's like, why do we prefer the artificial? You know, and there's no one answer to it. But now that was my nightmare. Now it's just grief because of the loss of species. And I think about, because evolution is one of the most fascinating things to me. And it took millions of years to create the diversity that we have had the chance to witness. And we're just burning it, you know, before we even know what it is. I mean, we know like just a fraction of it. And so grief and anger. And so you have to do something with that.
Yeah, those are just the first two stages, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
Standard.
No, but don't tell me that one because I think the end of that one is acceptance.
Oh, right, yeah.
Those are like
no change in that one.
Those are like the passage. Those are the five stages of grief or something, yeah. Right? Anger, bargaining.
I should get back on topic. I'm sorry.
Okay.
That was good, though. Because it's helping me. Thank you. I never thought about mastery and critique like that, actually. This kind of, it's a bit like self-satisfying. So we're in a place right now. We're in a field station in Itasca, Lake mm-hmm. Itasca. It is ostensibly the headwaters, the source. All these words that get applied to the beginnings mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. flow. And so it's a question more about that kind of thing. Like, how does it make you feel to be here? What does the beginning of a river even mean to you? Is that something that, because there was a discussion here the other day, for example, about like, you know, what is the headwaters? It's just a kind of a tourist thing where you jump on the rocks. And
I know.
Is the idea of a source meaningful to you?
No more than the idea of the mouth of the river or the middle of the river. I mean, it's just more of the river to me. I mean, and it's different because it's like, how does a river start? I mean, that's just a basic curiosity. How do you, something as mighty and as, you know, now fixed because of the way we've treated it, the way we've channelized it, as the Mississippi, you know, how does a great thing start? And it's all these little tributaries, right? It's all this drainage from all these different directions. And it's very hard to identify the source. And I think life is like that. So many of the important things, right? Even socially or ideas or even social movements, you know, it's people always want to get to the origin. And that makes sense in a way just because you want to understand, how did these happen? How do you make things happen? But, you know, really, it's sort of like, you know, the year 2000 was interesting, but really because of what we made of it. I mean, it was really just another turning of the planet, right? But we made it into this, and cultures have always done that, right? Had these special designations. I don't know. I think it's interesting. Yeah.
That's cool. That's the first time I've ever heard, like, there's so much deconstructionist. It's nice to hear sort of that it does memorialize something, and it's interesting to still pursue in its impossibility.
So interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And a biological fuel station. I mean, that's just like ice cream to me. You know, I love to see what they're doing and find out how what are the methods, and, you know, what are they finding out, and how do they work collectively. So tomorrow, hopefully, we'll find out some of that stuff.
So a kind of related question, and something that's probably both a consternation about how, let's just say, the conceptual transatlantic thing that we were talking about before, like the Anthropocene landing in different places in different ways and having a kind of activism orientation here and a hyper-academic Benjaminian take over here, you know, this kind of stuff, is to ask, like, having thought about the beginning and the source of the river, what an Anthropocene river is, because this is what we're here in a way to, it's the title of the project, you know. So what is an Anthropocene river as opposed to a river?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's one of the questions, I mean, to me, because I don't even know if I know what a river is. I mean, much less an Anthropocene river. So it's kind of discovering the two together. I mean, because there's so few rivers on this continent that haven't been so altered and controlled and dammed and levied and channelized to what we thought was important. And I think that's kind of key. It's like these paradigms that are going over the dam, so to speak. Or is it under the dam? Under the bridge. Anyway. So for instance, you know, to control flooding because the farmland of the Midwest was perceived to be so valuable, and for navigation. And are there other priorities now, you know? And it's like, I know these aren't easy questions. I mean, you know, it's easy to say, just get rid of the dams. The salmon can't get up the rivers. We're losing wetlands with these systems. But there are, those things were done to solve problems. And it really interests me that, well, for one thing, it does seem like part of the dialectic of history, you know, that you solve these problems and then you create new problems. It's kind of like Ulrich Beck writes about secondary modernism, and that secondary modernism is all about controlling the risks and dangers created by primary modernism. So that's kind of what we're witnessing. So what is an anthropogenic river? Well, we're looking at it down river. Up here, maybe it's not anthropogenic so much. I don't know. Is there anything that's not anthropogenic anymore? Anthropocenic? I don't know. And so that's a question. It's something to find out. Yeah. I mean, I'd really like to go on a very different kind of river after this, because there are some rivers that haven't been dammed and that are allowed to meander and flood their banks and, you know, all those things.
Thank you. I like the question of what a river is first.
Yeah.
Because it's also like a naming issue, isn't it? When you said that, I thought you were going to head in a slightly, like, the word river.
Yeah.
Anthropocenic already. Like,
right,
a name.
Sure. And we have, you know, like, what was it, you know, before we, it was like a huge, I mean, the delta of the Mississippi is vast. And, you know, all that area now, we call it a river, but it was a network. It was a meshwork. Of water and land. And something I just read was so interesting about how, oh yeah, it was James C. Scott who's written about the development of states and what the states' motivations were, et cetera. And one of the things was to separate the land from the water because mud is intolerable. Which is so great, you know, because that's like modern science. You know, you don't want any gray areas.
Yeah, drain the swamp.
yeah, drain the swamp. Mm.
So maybe one more question, because this has been...
I know, it's been really long.
I'm sorry. No, not your fault. I just realized I kept you longer than I thought I was going to. Because of that other discussion just about critique and stuff. You actually almost headed towards the answer anyway. So this is a trajectory that... I've been talking to some of the people who are actually going on the whole trip, and so it's a bit more hyper-relevant for them because they're going to actually do this kind of whole process and wind up in...
So rugged challenge.
New Orleans in November.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. But and I will not be doing that entire thing, but I'll be stopping in on parts of it. There's a question about like what it is that we're hoping. So if you're not doing the whole trip, you're doing part of it, maybe you can think about where you're going to land, but we could also just kind of imagine for ourselves like what it would be like to roll into New Orleans in whatever that is, 8 weeks or something, and what the end of the river would feel like, and what, you know, how you might imagine that, or how you might, or what we might hope that those people will experience or learn or, you know, see in that moment, or how you imagine the New Orleans appearing at the end, kind of.
What is I don't have a clue. I really don't. I mean, I, you know, like I said, I think, you know, I mean, it's as interesting to me as the so-called origins of the river, and I will be in New Orleans. We're going to join the canoers at Cairo, Illinois, and go down to Memphis. So I will see another leg of it in a different river, you know, than what we're seeing up here. And then I will be in New Orleans, which is a fascinating place, and I can completely understand why the Anthropocene is an urgent activist concept there, because they're on the front lines. I mean, you know, they've been through hell already, and it's not going to get better. And I mean, you know, they're looking at a kind of loss that's massive, you know, of their city. I mean, when the oceans really rise and the weather just keeps on pummeling us. Yeah, I don't know. What do you imagine is going
to
be?
Well, it's a bit more relevant when you're thinking about, when you're talking to somebody who's actually going to do the whole thing.
Like, yeah, it is.
It's just a question format, but
yeah.
With Nell, wonderful.
Yeah.
Really smart. And she was just like, she had this amazing answer about how she has this feeling that it's going to, I won't be able to quote her. Paraphrasing, it's like, you know, she said, here it feels small.
Right.
And I just think, like, by the end, it's going to, and she was reflecting on how it was going to make her feel sort of this bigness almost, not like in the sense of power, but like just this kind of largesse,
mm-hmm.
and the feeling of all the hands that touch the water and the mm-hmm. memories that are flowing downstream and then the actual pollution and the everything. It just seems to agglomerate this mm-hmm. incredible, both human and non-human,
mm-hmm.
energy as it passes through that whole landscape. And so she was just imagining it as much more, just this kind
well,
of small,
she's also done it.
Small to big. Yeah.
No, she didn't do it because that trip didn't make it to New Orleans.
She did a former run of it.
She did a former run of it, but as I understand that trip, they had so much trouble, so much bad weather, and also they had a lot of students of color on the trip, and they were so alienated by some of the communities they went through and harassed by the police, et cetera. You know, once they got to a certain latitude and below, and they had to stop and rethink the whole trip. Did she talk about that?
She didn't mention that, no. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you who can tell you about it is Joe. It's really interesting.
I should talk to him about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine a lot of, like, this is what we were talking about, the river as an, somebody said, oh, it's amazing how the river functions as this organizing principle, as a source.
Yeah, that was interesting.
I think it's a disorganizing principle, because it really, like all these things that the Huckabee has planned, also like some of these places, you know, I don't know, like St. Louis could have a flood or something, you know.
It's so ambitious.
Well, that is also just true when you look at how they've tried to organize.
I know.
Things from afar and all this stuff, it has been a disorganizing principle already.
But actually, you know, for the river, water organizes people in general. I mean, it has, historically.
Yeah.
But the whole thing about the Anthropocenic River, or the Anthropocene River, is about what we've done to try to make it an organizing force rather than a disorganizing force. So that's an interesting question you ask. You know, like, is it disorganizing or organizing? Probably both.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I just on a spatial level, you sort of understand where you think that river's going to go. But, I mean, just the amount of ambiguity that it represents in terms of people's lives. Tennessee Williams' writings about, you know, like, it's a beautiful river, but it's also an incredible monster. That just totally...
No, I know someone who died in it 2 years ago, swimming. It's really not something to just play around with, you know? So we've wanted to do something on the Mississippi for a long time, and I was overwhelmed by it because the barges... Have you ever been caught in a channel with a barge and you're in a small craft? It's like, really, you know, you have to just wait your turn, and you may run out of steam, you know, before you get your chance to get through. Anyway, it's, yeah. And they, you know, when they're moving, it's like, you're just more riffraff on the river to get out of the way.
Yeah.
So.
I wish them all the best, and I think, but I just think there's so much about these projects which, you know, I don't know, somehow the imaginary and the romanticism of like a mouth and a source and... Oh, we'll have these field stations, and you sort of forget how much chaos there is and all that. That's all, like, there's just so much turbulence about the running water itself, the kinds of communities that do organize themselves around the river, you know.
And, right.
You
know, and then the fact of the weather, which the river is part of. I mean, it really is literally part of. Like, I was interviewing Newton Harrison. Do you know the couple, the Harrisons? Really old, I mean, like 86. And Helen died, but they're early environmental artists. And they made a commitment, like in 63, that they wouldn't do any project that didn't benefit the wider ecology, et cetera. And one of their questions that they ask is, how big is here? So whenever they start, like, how big is here? So it's kind of like, it's a systems question, you know, like what connects to what, and how can you even think the scales of all the things that are interacting here? And so I said, well, we're doing this thing about the Mississippi River. How would I apply that question? He says, well, how would you? I said, well, the oceans, you know, it goes to the ocean. It starts with all these tributaries. He says, yeah, keep going. And then he's like, what about the meteorological cycles? You know, because that's what you're talking about with water. You know, the river is just part of that. And that was an interesting thing to contemplate.
That's true. We haven't talked a lot about atmospheres, and, you know, it tends to ground conversations a little bit. I really appreciate that.